You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, the final installment in our Brat Pack Summer miniseries covering the films of John Cryer, featuring Nerdy Punks, New Wave Geeks, Shutterbug Dorks, Friend-Zoned Stalkers, National Lampoon Losers, and A Legion of Hapless Virgins. Martin.
Yes.
His name is Blaine? That's a major appliance, not a name.
This is it, that's the end of the joke. And loses herself in her dreaming and sleep, and her lovers walk through in their clothes. She's pretty in pain, isn't she? Pretty in pain, isn't she? All of her lovers are talk of her notes and the flowers.
Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, we did it. We made it through the summer of Brat.
We're almost there.
And to cap this all off, we're going to do an episode on John Cryer, which seems strange in theory and honestly in practice, because he really only kind of did one thing for this time period, which was he played, you know, and I did kind of formulate a theory while watching these movies, is that like we always identify Anthony Michael Hall, especially from Breakfast Club, as being kind of like the most iconic dork.
Yeah, that and Weird
from
Science.
This period. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But here, I think John Cryer might actually be the most like recognizable geek from this kind of 80s run, because Ducky from Pretty in Pink, one of the three movies we're going to cover here, is probably like his signature role and also like one of the most recognizable roles from the John Hughes kind of oeuvre.
Yeah, because he's a classic second banana too. Like, so he is created this new kind of character. He's playing this very specific 80s nerd with this kind of punk aesthetic going on around him. But he also is that classic, you know, the best friend in even like a screwball comedy, or
he's the friend zoned dork.
Yeah. And it's funny because watching this movie, there's moments too, where, besides his love for her, where he's coded gay in a way. If you know, there's a way of
that is a big debate around this movie, is whether or not Ducky is gay, because that's been like almost like a queer theory 101 that's been applied to the movie, is that reading him as a either closeted or just, like you said, coded gay character.
Yeah, I mean, the scene in particular, I think, was him walking her into the prom, you know?
Yes.
It's this very, them both being outsiders in their own ways. Now, they put it as, obviously, there's two kids who are on some sort of, like, they talk about, they're from wrong side of the tracks, and have, you know, by the good graces of this rich area, been allowed to, you know, go to this richer school. So they have that outsider thing, but also they're outsiders in their, you know, love of music and a stranger style. I mean, both of them beyond the finances, like, you know, Andy does not have to dress so like, interestingly, you know, like she could.
Idiosyncratically.
Yeah, exactly. And the same for, I mean, obviously Ducky is very much like.
He's a flamboyant new wave kid.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, but it's also like an extension of, and we talked about this, especially with the movie we just watched before we started recording here, which was Penelope Spheeris's Dudes, is that Cryer, you know, we identify him with Ducky, but he kind of did this all through the 80s, even in lesser seen movies. Like there was a movie that I watched for this episode called No Small Affair, which is directed by Jerry Schatzberg, of all people, who made Panic in Needle Park,
Scarecrow,
Street Smart with Christopher Reeve and Morgan Freeman, where Morgan Freeman, I believe, was nominated for an Oscar to playing a killer pimp in Times Square in like the late 80s. Like, he was mostly known for making these kind of gritty, dark character dramas that kind of ambled along, especially Panic in Needle Park and Scarecrow, if you've ever seen those movies. Like Scarecrow in particular, you know, with Al Pacino and Gene Hackman, there's really no narrative to the movie. It's just about two fucking losers who hit the road across America with a dream, and it ends quite tragically, let's say, for those who haven't seen it. I mean, classic New Hollywood bullshit.
Yeah.
You know?
Almost a Midnight Cowboy kind of.
Yeah, very much so in that vein. And Panic in Needle Park is, again, with young Pacino, I believe pre-Godfather Pacino in, like, 71.
Yeah.
And, like, that's a drug addiction New York movie, too, that's quite harrowing to sit through. Not a fun film. So, like, watching him apply this kind of New Hollywood, loosey-goosey, actorly vibes ethos to what's essentially like a teen boner comedy is really fascinating. Now, No Small Affair, not particularly good, but kind of a really unique relic from the time period. And to set the stage, it's about John Cryer is just another geek. And this is 3 years before he plays Ducky. You know, and he's a photographer, and one day he's shooting pictures on a pier, and he captures this amazing image of this beautiful woman who's played by Demi Moore, another one of the Brat Pack kind of lifers, and she turns out to be an aspiring rock singer at this local club that's run by George Wendt, Norm from Cheers, of all fucking people, and, like, she, you know, a lot of the movie is her story about navigating this world of, like, very lecherous men, like, who are, like her band kind of quits on her. She's dating, like, the one guitarist at one point, and, like, they break up. Because what he essentially captures is, like, them in the middle of a breakup. And, you know, she needs to get a new band and stuff. And he, playing kind of, like, the prototypical John Cryer role, he's like a 16-year-old lovelorn dork who instantly is like, well, I will be your knight in shining armor and try to do anything to help you succeed, you know, and he becomes like her little lapdog, essentially. But the movie has no real narrative beyond that, because it's like he has an older brother who's getting married. They go to like a bachelor party, and they even pay to have a hooker come in, and the hooker's supposed to bang his older brother, but they end up trying to set her up, this gorgeous woman, with John Cryer's character. And of course they have this really awkward, like, meet cute type thing where she in the end is like, he's just a really nice kid. Like, the mom walks in on them and stuff. It's just classic, again, like 80s boner comedy setups, but like shot through the lens of this guy who only knew how to make these 70s character studies. And then, like, the cast on it, too, is just really, really strange. Like, Jeffrey Tambor plays, like, his mom's new boyfriend and kind of becomes... He's doing the Jeffrey Tambor kind of, like, schlubby, monotone thing, doling out wisdom here and there, and, like, kind of becoming, like, the kid's advocate with the mom, too, of being like, oh, he's just going to be a boy. Just let him go out in the streets and, you know, chase this woman and chase his dreams. And then Jennifer Tilly, who can't be more than like 19, is like the girl who has a crush on John Cryer, and she's so cute in this movie. She's also like a big nerd. She wears these huge glasses, but she also still looks like Jennifer Tilly at fucking 19. And she's just playing Pac-Man the whole time, and wants nothing to do more than to just have John Cryer come play Pac-Man with her. And you're sitting there being like, Jennifer Tilly, if I was 19 right now with you and you asked me to play Pac-Man with you, let me tell you, I would do nothing else in the world. But it's just a really odd movie, because then, of course, he starts pulling all these weird stunts to try and get Demi Moore's affections, where he like, because he's saving up to go overseas to Europe to become like a photographer, and he spends his whole life savings on buying these really odd ads that are on the top of taxis in San Francisco, which this movie is beautifully shot, by the way. And they're basically like advertising like, this girl's great, you should give her a call and give her a job, without thinking about the fact that like every creep in San Francisco is now going to ring this girl up being like, are you a hooker, essentially? Like, what services do you offer exactly? I don't know. It's just, it's a really strange role. But where I'm kind of going with this is that like he already sort of had his share of the market cornered playing these kind of dorks. And then you just see him sort of refine it and tailor it to whatever the director's vision was or what was popular at the time. Because, like, you know, in Dudes, the Penelope Spheeris movie, he essentially plays another nerd, but he's just a nerdy punk. And then in Ducky, he's the new wave punk who, like, that's the ultimate evolution of his character, to where he plays that alongside Molly Ringwald. And, like, he really brings... Now, we can talk about, like, the positives and negatives of Ducky and how that character has aged throughout time. But, like, you know, he brings a real dimensionality to that character that otherwise could have just been, like, to your point, like, a stock loser BFF.
Yeah, because he, I mean, he's benefits from, I mean, Howard Deutsch directing the hell out of Pretty in Pink. And you are surrounded by like,
which is arguably John Hughes's best script.
I think so, and it's also the characters are also well drawn, and even Ducky of like, especially I think of, you know, the dad character played by Harrodine Stanton
in one of his stealthily best performances.
Oh, he's just he's
incredible.
He brings the heat, and there's the scene where they finally break down, and he has to admit like his wife's never coming back, that he's been abandoned, and that he has been lying to his daughter, that he's been, you know, pretending to go to work. There's a wonderful scene even between him and John Cryer out on the front when, you know, John Cryer's drinking fucking...
You can't force these things.
Yeah, and it's just this really sweet thing, and, like, John Cryer's really holding his own, you know? And
Harry Dean Stanton being Harry Dean Stanton, too, is you can tell, looks at this kid and is like, look at this fucking dork, but he's so empathetic and warm in Pretty in Pink that he can't help but still just play father to him. Like, oh my God, he's so good in this movie.
Well, and if there's any problems with Ducky, I mean, it is all in the script, you know? And I think
yeah.
the one scene for me where I feel at the time when I first saw it, which was in the 90s, so probably I first saw this when I was only 5 or 6. It was only 5 or 6 years old. You know, like it was early 90s when I think I first saw it.
I saw it on TV at some point.
Yeah.
Like on TBS or one of those like syndicated kind of, you know, afternoon screenings where, you know, it was just, they did all the John Hughes movies in a row, like 16 Candles, Breakfast Club, Pretty in Pink, you know?
And this one is like, It's so like, it's so beautifully done, because I was talking to a friend who does, she writes like, she's a novelist that writes kind of romantic comedies and things like that. And she was saying like, you know, I want to do something with a little bit more edge, you know, but not so much that it loses the fact that it's a, you know, a rom-com. And I was like, have you seen Pretty in Pink or Say Anything? Cause those two are like the 1-2 punch for me.
Yeah.
Of that late 80s. You know, it's really funny. It has really irreverent humor, but then it has those moments of like, oh shit, like Say Anything, my dad's being arrested for fucking fraud, you know? And then in this one too, you have like the real like raw sense of like what economics have done to this town and have done to like her and Ducky's character, the places that they live, the dad who beyond his wife leaving him just seems like he's given up. Like, we're never going to get ahead in this life.
Well, he's crushed by depression.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it's a
really... But financial helps push that down.
Exactly, and it's a really great and honestly truthful portrait of a guy struggling through depression and just struggling to get out of bed every day and do anything beyond just drinking his white cans of Budweiser.
Yeah, absolutely. But this... I haven't seen this in years, but
arguably the greatest teen movie ever made. That's my hottest take about Pretty in Pink.
I mean, hands down. So I was watching it, and first of all, just forgetting that, you know, Tak Fujimoto shot this thing and shot the fuck out of it.
It looks like a Jonathan Demme movie.
It, well, it's a fucking film, you know. I think that that's what sticks out. That like, I like most movies we've talked about, but this one is like artistically fascinating. The way it's shot. Howard Deutsch, and I'm really, really great director. I mean, I'm also a fan of like Some Kind of Wonderful, which actually sounds like a similar plot to the first one we were talking about.
Well, it's the same narrative,
yeah,
of like, will she or won't she pick one guy over the other, only it inverts the ending. For those, I'm sorry, spoilers for those who haven't seen Some Kind of Wonderful, is that Some Kind of Wonderful was the original ending to Pretty in Pink.
She, yeah.
Because in the original ending of Pretty in Pink, you know, Andy picks Ducky to fall in love with. They tested it. And Andrew McCarthy in Bratz goes into this, is that they tested it. And the, you know, the teenage audience who watched it rejected it because there is like, there's no fucking way that this nerdy, you know, because Andy's kind of like the original Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she's just made flesh and humanized a lot better than, like, say, Summer and 500 Days of Summer. Is that, like, you know, she's torn between Andrew McCarthy's rich kid, preppy, nice guy, and Ducky, who's pining for her and has had a crush on her entire life. And, like, she ultimately, in the end of the original cut, picks Ducky. Well, the teenage audience went, well, there's no fucking way. Like, if she had the actual choice between these two dudes, she's going to pick the rich, good-looking, nice kid over Ducky 7 days a week, you know? So they actually went back and reshot it. Andrew McCarthy and Bratz said that, like, he was doing a play or something in Broadway. Where he had a shaved head because he was something like, I think it was like a Vietnam play or something on stage.
Yeah, he was a soldier, yeah.
Yeah, and he had to come in and wear this terrible wig, which I had never noticed before in all the times I had seen Pretty in Pink until this time now that he pointed it out. And the wig actually is pretty fucking bad.
I tried to watch it this time. I know, obviously, watching the doc where it is, but... You know, I remember I had a friend who told me last year before Bratz, because she's a huge fan of this movie, and was like, oh, did you know that wasn't the original ending? And it's funny to think about what could have been, because, I mean, talk about a film that is made for a specific era. If that film were made today or in the 2000s, people wouldn't bat an eye at Ducky being the one who gets her.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because the Judd Apatow era of the nerd gets the girl. And usually, you know, I remember in this great article...
Which became dubbed the Frat Pack.
The Frat Pack. Well, and there was that article in Sight and Sound, I remember. Yeah. And they had that great point of, in the 80s and a lot in the early 90s, the enemy of your main nerdy character was the jock. And in the Apatow era, the main enemy is himself. It's his own... It's like, you think about it, Knocked Up. There's no guy fighting for the love of Katherine Heigl. It's just his, you know,
he has to improve himself. It's the same with 40-year-old Virgin.
Exactly.
A guy has to overcome his own shortcomings
and grow up
as a human being. And yeah, stop being a man child essentially in order to get this girl who's totally out of his league.
But feel me, think about the end of fucking Superbad. I mean, like, you have Jonah Hill realistically getting Jules, played by Emma Stone, you know.
Which is insane.
Which is insane. But, like, you have this sense of that also, the theme of its personality that counts. But that also, I think, plays to Ducky, even for that era maybe, while he's remembered fondly, the movie doesn't build that in at all, that she would pick him at all. I feel like she rebuffs him the entire time, and in no sense do I ever feel like there's a chance. Is that being fair?
No, it's totally fair. I actually, my feelings are even stronger than that, is because, and it's the thing to go back to the idea of what's aged the worst about this movie, is that Ducky is a shithead.
Oh yeah.
Like, he's become lionized over time as being this great best friend and this iconic character from the era. But when you go back and revisit the movie, like, he's a terrible person to her. He's a bad friend to her. He's obsessive. He literally rides his bike past her house every day. That's psycho restraining.
Calls her every 5 minutes till she picks up.
Calls her all the time. Like, yeah, there's that scene that almost feels like the basis for that funny scene in Swingers where Jon Favreau calls the girl that he meets in the bar over and over again until she finally picks up and is like, don't ever call me again, essentially. But like, Ducky is just, he's not a great person. And then he goes after she rejects him and hooks up with the older lady who's essentially playing her surrogate mother in Annie Potts, who, I mean, let's be fair, in this movie and in life in general during this time period, I mean, between this and Corvette Summer, like, love of my life, Annie Potts, would ruin my life for her at any point if I met these characters from either one of those movies. But, like, think about that. Ducky's such a fucking shithead that it's not only like he goes after her best friend, but he goes after the woman who's taking the place spiritually of the woman who abandoned Andy and gave birth to her. Like, that's fucked up.
Well, I, you know, I can't believe I'm sticking up for Ducky here. Good God, what's happened to my life? I'm not sticking up for him, but I've always seen his thing with Annie Potts as like, he's harmless to her. She's petting on the head, like, because honestly, like, the way the scene plays out is she's like, I don't know what I'm doing here. He was just really, really sad. She calls him the Duck Man. He's part of like their little crew. He hangs out at the record store. He knows her as well, I think, as Andy knows her, and the sense that, you know, he's just brokenhearted. And she even jokes for the next day. She's like, wow, the Duck Man really can kiss, I'll tell you that. And it's like, I don't think there's ever any chance of him get, you know what I mean, getting with her.
But it's still the motivation behind it is bonkers.
Which, again, in a way actually makes it worse, because like, it's like, dude, you know, like, you have no chance with her. And then he gets fucking Kirstie Swanson. That's the girl who looks at him in the fucking Buffy the Vampire
Slayer. That's who that is. It's Buffy. I knew I recognized her, and I meant to look it up. Like, yeah, he loses Andy at the end, but he gets
Kirstie Swanson. Sorry. Yeah.
But he gets Buffy the Vampire Slayer, who's now, like, Psycho MAGA.
Oh,
so
she's
sorry.
Crazy.
Sorry, Ducky. I guess you get what you deserve in the end. But, like, yeah, it's a bonkers character turn for somebody that we're supposed to, by the end of the script, the original scripted movie, I guess we should say, advocate for being like the love of Andy's life. And it doesn't make any fucking sense.
Well, if you think of it in, agree, if you think of it in like the structure of the classic, you know, rom-com, which, I mean, this is a really great, I think it's a very well-written script that is somewhat surprising when it wants to be.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because I think
it zags a lot.
It does, because it's a little bit softer in the turns too. Again, with a normal romantic comedy, it's like, okay, you have that moment where the former lover shows up, steps in between our two star-crossed lovers. That's the end of act two. Then we go into act three of them, you know, one of them having to convince the other, oh, it was a misunderstanding. With this one, literally, Andrew McCarthy just has a conversation with James Spader, and he's like, hey, you shouldn't date her. And then he just doesn't call her again. It's a really weird, there's not a big moment. Like, it is. It's all that happens. It's just that it's right after that conversation with him.
Okay. I think this is where I'll push back. One of the things about the script that I really like is that it layers.
I don't think it's a good thing, but go ahead.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm not bashing it.
No, but I mean, just the turn is that it's not just a conversation. It's the culmination of several conversations.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's where my pushback's coming, is that it's like Steph, James Spader's character, who we need to talk about James Spader.
Oh.
He's incredible.
I mean, this is
movie.
The ultimate. I mean, we talked about Less Than Zero, but I said this was my favorite of his, like,
yeah,
the
well,
ultimate.
Rip is almost like Steph in college.
Yeah. Oh,
you
yeah.
know what I mean?
I mean, like, he's even, like, next has step. The drugs on the table, like.
Has the yeah. drugs on the table, dresses the same way, comes from the rich parents and the rich background. Like, one is the extension of the other. You know what I mean? But, like, Steph is constantly needling Andrew McCarthy's character, because he's been rejected by Andy in the past, and also, like, he's the rich, preppy asshole. He's the one that, when we talk about, you know, in the Frat Pack movies, he's the one who's absent. You know, like, he's the villain who's just sneering in the background the whole time.
I mean, you,
like,
do get Sack in Wedding Crashers, which is the closest thing.
Sack, sort of, but do we count Wedding Crashers as one of the Frat Pack
not
movies?
Technically, but it's kind
that's
of
Vince Vaughn was a little older than those guys.
It dances in a little bit,
in and out, and it follows the same structure. And you also have Rachel McAdams in, like, one of her earliest roles in that. But this isn't a Wedding Crashers podcast.
No, it's not.
This is a Pretty in Pink podcast. But we see Steph constantly undermining Andy out of jealousy and out of just this really well-layered class divide and class war that's happening in the background.
No, you're right. I think we're actually agreeing more. I think it's what I find interesting is it is more of a subtle turn. Like you're saying, it's these seeds that have been planted for more than half the film, you know, because again, I was thinking of a more by the numbers romantic comedy. It would have been a much bigger gesture that would have made them split, a bigger fight. They had to fight after he stops calling. So I think what I mean to say,
where she corners him in the hallway.
Oh, it's great.
That scene is incredible. And also the look on Andrew McCarthy's face of just like pure terror as this girl's like ripping into him.
Well, because that scene, and then I think it's immediately after, it's great. You have, you know, James Spader literally watching from the corner, and then
Ducky goes after
and
him.
And then you have that great, and that actually I think is one of my favorite performance moments of John Cryer in any of these, is like his silent acting, is that the look he gives Steph of everything there, of like he never has a line, of basically saying, you know, I love her more than anyone possibly could. You're talking about the most important thing to me in my entire life. And he just sends it all with his eyes. And he really like, and it's amazing to have talk about.
Yeah, because he hears Spader say something like she's
trash.
Put her
she's
with
not
a trash
worth
where
it.
She belongs, essentially.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, but it's also, it's Ducky's redemptive moment.
Yeah.
Of like, he puts all the other bullshit behind him and he's like, this is still my best friend. I'm still going to fucking kill you if you mess with her.
Well, and this is the moment that would be the thing that would explain them getting together.
No, no, exactly.
This is, like you said, this is his moment of like proving it, even though she doesn't see it.
Well, and it's also the thing that undermines the gay subtext, or I guess the gay reading of the movie, is that like when Ducky arrives at the prom, he's not arriving as the best friend. He's arriving as the knight in shining armor who went out of his way and risked getting thrown out of school to beat the shit out of the guy who disrespected her.
But I'm so glad. I like the way that it ends as it does, because I think,
well, it's more realistic.
It's more realistic, and I just like Ducky as this character that we've all had in our lives, whether it be a person who has romantic feelings for us, but it's like, we all need that kind of friend, like, you know, and he does fuck up a lot, but it's also like, when you have friends you've had for that long, they've known each other since they were obviously like kindergarten.
Yeah.
You know, and they've been, you know, they've been like side by side, especially again, being these lower income kids in this richer high school, you know, and you see that moment of like, you can never undo, even that moment where he basically says, I can't see you anymore. I can't like you anymore because you're going with Blaine. And you see her in her eyes. It's kind of like her heart breaking is like, I don't want this guy out of my life. Like, she never said that,
yeah.
You know, she jokes around like, God, Duck, you're driving me crazy. But it's like, that is her best friend.
Yeah.
You know, and I think I think it works out really well the way it is.
Well, and the bigger redemptive moment is that one in the end when Ducky shakes Blaine's hand.
Yeah.
And he even like laughs about it, where he's like, I can't believe I'm fucking doing this. But he swallows his pride and his love for her. And he's like, well, if I actually am going to be this person's best friend and commit to it, I have to accept that she loves this guy and wish her the best, you know, and that means being, if not buddies with him, at least cordial.
Well, and then you have, again, the Chrissy Swanson moment, which obviously is, you know, in this probably shit show of, shit, we got to reshoot this ending, like, and quick, right, after the poor public screening, is, well, we got to give Ducky a bone here, right? But it ends up being, like, one of the most classic shots from the movie.
No pun intended.
Which is used in a lot of the, like, remember the trailers from the era was him pointing at himself, like, you looking at me? Like, it's a classic Ducky moment, which wouldn't have been there if we had the original ending.
Now, can we talk about Hiding Out? Because Hiding Out, in a strange way, plays as the perfect B-side to Pretty in Pink.
Yeah.
So Hiding Out is, I think at this point, kind of a rarity. Like, it's on Amazon Prime. That's how we both watched it. And this was, to set up some backstory for me, so Hiding Out, I saw on VHS when I was 12. And I hadn't seen it since then because I couldn't remember the name of the movie for almost three decades now. and I could only really remember one scene from it. I knew John Cryer, I thought, was in it. It was some guy who was basically played like a dorky dude. And I remembered, like, not just one scene. I remembered the big climax on the catwalk where he's showing down against the gangsters. But I also remembered him dyeing his hair in the gas station bathroom.
Fugitive style. Yeah.
Where he makes it blonde on the sides and becomes like this new wave kind of like nerd. But for the life of me, for almost 30 years, I couldn't remember what the fuck this movie was called. And then when we were watching it and like my brain started to click, I was like, is this the movie? And then we got to the ending of it. I was like, this is the fucking movie. It's hiding out.
It's the one.
This is the movie that's literally been haunting me for 30 years is this weird John Cryer movie with one of the most batshit central premises of all time because it's about a stockbroker who's doing insider trading or something for a mobster.
Yeah, they did.
And is going to testify against him?
They were money laundering. So they were basically taking this guy's money and putting it through the stock system.
Are you sure?
They literally say in the first scene, it goes, basically, we've been washing his money for him.
Okay.
Like, it's when they're in the bathroom. He's talking to the guy from The Burning and from...
oh, that's right.
And also that he's the main bad Italian in Last Man Standing.
Also shows up in Sopranos.
Yeah.
So he is wearing a ridiculous beard that looks like he bought it from Halloween Adventure.
It looks like a little Rascals.
Well, if he was like a Halloween Adventure costume of stockbroker in the 80s, that's what John Cryer is dressed like. He's got this like chin strap beard and shit. Just looks heinous. You also pointed out that he kind of looks like Pete Davidson.
Dude, there are some screenshots I sent you that are like, because he's got the big lips too. Like
huge lips.
And the same teeth and the same kind of like, has that kind of slack jaw look sometimes, that kind of like dead stare.
Andy, you know, after Andy turned him down, and if he hadn't seen Christy Swanson, he would have been a huge hit on the glory hole circuit.
Talk about hiding out.
Ducky's in the bathroom stall, not the closet. But anyway.
Hiding out the sausage.
But right. Easy. But so he, you know, has hitmen coming after him because he agrees to testify and go undercover.
Or not even
FBI.
Agree. He just like, they find him, the FBI guys, right?
Well, no, they have that one cut where he's been with them for almost 2 weeks at that point, providing them information. And one of the FBI agents is John fucking Spencer.
Dude,
from
it's
the
awesome.
West Wing and The Rock. He's amazing. I love him. One of my favorite character actors of all time. Is that craggy, like Midwestern Chicago voice going. But like, so they lose him. So he goes and he hides out at a high school in Delaware?
Yeah, I think
so. Of all places?
Yeah.
With his cousin, who's like 16 or 17 and going to high school. He, you know, is on the run, shaves his crappy beard, or I guess takes the glue off, take your pick, dyes the sides of his hair accidentally, like neon, like bright yellow
bleach,
almost. Yeah. And like starts dressing more or less like Ducky.
And like Bender. He literally comes down. He looks like John Bender with the fucking...
Yeah, with the coat and the trench coat
and the boots.
Because he trades with a homeless dude for like his suit.
You know who
everything.
He is?
Who?
He's Kyle Reese.
A little bit.
He just comes out. He just time traveled.
Well, and then he goes undercover in a high school and is just a high school student. And it's like one of these movies that, A... Like, let's face it, Gen Z, they're not gonna stand for this age gap shenanigans, especially when he starts getting to the romance with Annabeth Gish.
Yeah.
But then B, this wouldn't work today because all it would take is one dickhead with an iPhone who puts him in like a TikTok video and he starts to get popular and run for like class president, which again, inexplicably insane central premise. And it would just go online and the hitman would be like, oh, there he is. He's in Delaware.
I liked this movie a lot.
It's so much fun.
But it feels like a first draft. Like, honestly, like the idea, because like you compare this to a somewhat similar setup of Kindergarten Cop, right? Where like,
oh,
where,
yeah,
where,
I didn't think of that.
Where
movie.
You have your central character has a very important reason to be there and something to figure out while they're there. But while it's happening, they end up being really good at like the his teaching thing. And this one,
which is also insane because Arnold doesn't look like a kindergarten teacher.
No, but he looks like Arnold. But the script of Kindergarten Cop is perfect. Like it literally is like it's perfect. Like you have complete.
Are we sure?
It is.
You have I love that movie.
No, but you have motivation all the time. Ivan Reitman directs it so perfectly. Like you always know. Like there's a reason for him to be there. There's a there's always everything's connected. This one has some more aimless shenanigans of like, dude, why do you have to be at the high school? You could just hide in a barn.
Well, you know what this movie reminds me of are the Martin Brest movies. It reminds me a lot of Midnight Run in particular. Like, he's even in those early scenes, like, it feels very Brestian, I guess, because you're just hanging out with these guys as the mob hitmen come after them, and suddenly it becomes this dark kind of on-the-run, like, action movie. But then, when he gets into the high school, it's really shaggy again, and you're just kind of like doing a teen movie.
You don't understand, like, again, like why he keeps going. Cause even there's a moment to speak to, you know, what you're talking about with Annabeth Gish, like,
who's super cute.
She's super cute, and you have the sense that he's.
Would,
like,
I commit statutory rape with Annabeth Gish? Probably not.
Well, he's trying to rebuff her, right? And then. And
the movie goes out of its way to comment several times of like, hey, he's a grown ass man. He should not be with this teenage girl.
Well, it almost has a similar feel to Marty and his mom in like Back to the Future, right? It's like, this can never be.
Right.
Like, you're flirting with me, but like.
Until it is.
But there's a, yeah. Now, here's the thing.
It's the weirdest part of the movie.
If my mom were Leah Thompson, I would have sex with my mom. But there's.
Go on.
If it was Leah Thompson.
Sir.
But.
Martin. True Confessions with Martin Carlson.
But
who else, if they played your mom, would you ban? Jennifer Connelly.
I mean, yeah.
Like, I don't care. It's just a little incest.
Yeah, exactly.
And all of a sudden, so I always wondered in Back to the Future, not to go on too far of a tangent.
We should cut a lot of this.
No, it's all staying in, baby. You've set yourself up. So if he actually did fuck Leah Thompson, his mother.
Yeah. The Earth would split in half.
Well, not only the Earth would split in half, would, like, you know how, like, the pictures faded and stuff, like, in real time, like, as, like, you know,
yeah.
And that was kind of like the ticking clock that Marty McFly had to
mm-hmm.
run against in order to get his mission done. If he fucked his mom and it changed the space-time continuum or the timeline,
yeah,
would he develop, like, Down syndrome in real time or inbreeding? Seriously.
Well, it's
like
it's,
he's just mid thrust and all of a sudden he's like, Mom.
Jesus. He's like, no, it's like this, it's the plot of Predestination, the Spring Brothers movie.
Where I've never seen that one.
He fucks himself.
Oh,
and they have a baby.
Spoiler alert for Predestination.
No, that's the twist. Sorry, y'all. But I saw it in the theaters and.
It's like the original ending of Butterfly Effect where he goes back and strangles himself in the uterus.
You know what it is?
This is an insane movie.
Well, there was the Spirit Brothers and they were at South by. I remember them saying they literally wanted to make the tagline, go fuck yourself. Because it's like he has a sex change during the time stuff and it's played by Sarah from Secession.
Sure.
And
Sarah Snook.
He ends up having sex with the female version of himself, and they have a baby, which is him. It's just, it's
I
fucking,
need to watch this movie now. It sounds insane.
It's really, it's not, I don't like it.
Yeah.
But
to back to the original point, would that happen? Would he become quirky in real time?
Don't.
Think about it. Get back to me.
I'm going to think about it a lot tonight.
And so hiding out. It becomes on and off, like it shifts from being kind of a Brestian action movie to a standard teen high school movie where like he takes on basically like the jock who Annabeth Gish was dating, who is participating in a school president campaign that's rigged by
the bad English teacher.
English teacher who. It seems like he may have been trading sexual favors with her.
There's
that?
A sense that that might have.
Like, yeah, that might have been lost. Like, because this movie's only, again, like 89 minutes long or whatever. And if there was an hour 40 cut, I feel like we'd get some answers to those questions. Because I think they were fucking, too.
Well, it's like you said, like there's a lot of just aimless kind of wandering, especially like in obviously in Act Two. But it's funny though. I mean, just to talk about John Cryer as like a star persona, is he's the cool guy in this movie. Like he's a dirt. He's
well,
a dork.
That's what the makes it the bead side. Yeah. To Pretty in Pink is that this movie asks the question, what if Ducky was cool?
Well, because it's, you know, there's this is a plot we've seen a lot of, like, the guy or the woman who comes into a new situation, and just by being themselves, accidentally everyone is like, they're the coolest person in the world.
Yeah.
Because he is from this other world, you know, like, he's not, they're making Delaware seem somewhat podunk, you know, and that he's a city boy.
And as somebody who's spent quite a bit of time in Delaware, let me tell you. It is kind of podo.
Yeah, I mean, it reminded me of, like, Indiana, where I grew up, you know, and it's
let's
like.
Let's not take it that far, sir.
Yeah, but he brings in, like, this cool factor, and it's almost like he can't help. Again, like Marty McFly, right? Marty McFly can't help but
Well, he's
do,
bringing in knowledge
cool.
from the future,
yeah.
so to speak, where Marty McFly brings rock and roll to the 50s. You know,
I mean, even telling the dad
about doing the taxes and stuff and like the write off in it. He's bringing this adult knowledge to teenage scenarios.
Exactly,
it's doing the That's thing the of like the big like, what if you could go back and relive a part of your life with the knowledge that you have now? That's essentially the fantasy that's playing out and hiding out. But then. The mobsters find him. There's a big shootout. And then the scene that I remember from my youth so vividly, you know, he has a showdown with an assassin on a catwalk where the dude falls to his death. That was the thing that was, for whatever reason, from hiding out, was burned into my brain for 30 fucking years. And I'm so glad that I got to revisit it. Then he finally gets to fuck Annabeth Gish in college, which is the strangest coda to a movie I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, because he goes into witness protection after he testifies.
Becomes a new person.
And decides to get a new degree in education and just show up and be like, hey,
I'm a professor here now?
By the way, are you still seeing that guy? She's like, no. And they just like, cool, guess we're a couple now forever.
Well, and that guy meaning him.
Yeah.
So, but isn't he a professor at the college?
No, he's studying. He started college again.
Okay.
Like he's as a younger guy, he's like,
Are we sure?
Yes. He's like, I'm studying education to be a teacher. Because I think the idea another setup would be Billy Madison, another comp, you know, in a way of like this older person going in and
who
then
surprisingly also had Down syndrome.
And getting to start over again.
Yeah.
You know, an idea of like, I'm getting to, you know, do it again. One fine piece of ace. Carl, good to see you. But I think this film also pairs well with that the film Plainclothes, which
you showed me the trailer to and I've never seen. Yeah. Why don't you set the stage for Plainclothes, which seems equally bizarre, maybe more bizarre because of who they chose to star in this movie.
So they choose Arliss Howard.
Who looks 40.
Who looks like very old in this movie. And I think he was in his 20s when they shot it, but he looks old as fuck. Like, I buy John Cryer shaving and looking like he could play a movie.
Yeah, because he always had a baby face. And they even set it up in that diner scene in the early part of Hiding Out where the waitress is like, can I see some ID for, like, you know, whatever he orders, a bourbon at, like, 9 in the morning.
Yeah, and it's
Or it's a scotch.
It's Arliss Howard. It's a similar thing, but he purposely goes in as an undercover cop because his brother is killed, and he believes it's actually more like 21 Jump Street, the show,
yeah.
the movie of like we gotta infiltrate and figure out what's going on with this kind of this crime, and it's the same thing but this one's a little different in that he falls for a teacher, and she thinks there's a line in the sand. It's like this, I can't with a student, and then the ending is, by the way, I'm actually 26. She's like, yes! And then they hook up.
You can totally finger blast me now.
Yeah. It's Martha Coolidge, so director of
Valley Girl.
Valley Girl and Real Genius, one of my favorite movies. And I watched it because I was like, man, I like all her movies. I should see this. And it's not great.
No, it looked horrible.
Yeah, and also
I'm never going to watch it.
John Cryer is a more charming star than Arliss Howard for a movie like that.
I mean, he's a more sensible pick, that's for sure. Oh, he doesn't totally look 45.
Well, physically and his character wise, Arliss Howard, he even acts like he's like a fuddy duddy in this movie, and I don't think it's just they give him a weird hat and he looks like a geek and not in the right way.
Plain clothes looked like if they stretched that Steve Buscemi "Hello, fellow kids" meme out into a feature length film.
That's it. The central conceit doesn't work.
No, it's stupid as fuck. But speaking of things that are also stupid as fuck, Dudes. Penelope Spheeris's Dudes, which was a lot of fun, dumb as hell, and feels almost like a spiritual companion piece to Repo Man more than anything else, because it's John Cryer as a punk with a best friend played by Daniel
Roebuck,
who you pointed out, and I actually didn't know this, has become one of Rob Zombie's kind of regular players as of late.
Yeah, but also very famous for River's Edge as the killer.
Yes.
Yeah, another great teen movie.
Yep, the kind of weird, schlubby, fat boy. But like here, he's got the mohawk. He reminds me a lot of the guy who was in Night of the Demons.
Oh, Stooge.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like I watched that last week.
He's kind of like the nicer version of that character. But it's about these two, punks who take a road trip, and you want to talk about, aimless. It has like almost no narrative. The only storyline it really has is their other friend, who's played by Flea, is killed by a roaming gang of bad guys led by Lee Ving from the band Fear.
Yep.
And they go after them to seek revenge. And what you kind of come to realize as the movie goes on is that it's Penelope Spheeris essentially making a punk rock Western.
Yeah.
It's closer than in spirit to Alex Cox, even more so because of this fact. Because like she
straight
even,
to hell or something.
Straight to hell or Walker.
Yeah.
Like it has this very surreal, goofy tone. There's like a disappearing ghost cowboy that keeps, popping back up. Daniel Roebuck's character has a fever dream one night that he is a Native American warrior.
And that he was killed.
He was killed in the past by a Confederate soldier.
Union people.
And now resurrected and becomes the tracker to hunt down Lee Ving. Very strange movie. And then, she makes it pretty explicit because there's the whole scene where they go into the movie theater and watch Jesse James, which is played by the old-timey Western actor Leon Power. Tyrone Power.
Tyrone Power.
Who was also a film noir actor too.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting, goofy, freewheeling movie that feels like an extension of the stuff that Spheeris was making in the early 80s when she was part of the punk scene and made, the decline of Western civilization documentaries when she was hanging out with, Darby Crash and the Germs and X and John Doe and, a pre Henry Rollins Black Flag. And then, she brought these people with her, like Lee Ving and Fear. They're featured in this movie as well. And it's like, she brings these people with her to make, Suburbia, which also has Flea in it. And if you've never seen Suburbia, which I know Martin's never seen it yet, incredible movie. It's like a Roger Corman production about a group, a family more or less of like squatting punks and their misadventures that ends in a very sad fashion. And it more mirrors Decline of Western Civilization 3, which is, so for those who haven't seen the Decline movies, like Decline 1 is essentially a chronicle of the LA punk scene during the early 80s and the LA hardcore scene that was kind of coming out of the cracks of Skid Row. And then Decline 2 is in the mid 80s, and that's during the height of the hair metal scene. And it has interviews with like Gene Simmons and shit. And it's very goofy and is more or less mocking the guys that are featured in it as much as it is celebrating the music. And then Decline 3, which when I saw her appear at AFS almost 10 years ago now, she stated that she had never really watched or publicly screened Decline 3 because it's so hard for her to see, because it's about the kids and these, particularly these homeless kids who existed inside of the scene, who all developed these debilitating drug addictions and like lives on the street, and end up also meeting some very tragic fates. And it's a tough movie to sit through. And Suburbia more mirrors the kids from Decline 3 and is about the lives of these people who just existed in this scene and were kind of sacrifices on the altar of like their greatest interest, if that makes sense. But Dudes is the goofy, I mean, you even said almost feels like kind of like a precursor to Wayne's World and the SNL type movies she would make later.
Yeah. I mean, you have the whole scene of like them almost getting ready to headbang. They're not headbangers, but it's like listening to music. They're singing, Hava and Agita Hava together.
Yeah.
And it's this whole just kind of funny moment of them just goofing off. And there is a lot of like, again, not a lot happening where he and his buddy are just kind of just fucking off. And then, you know, it's funny because John Cryer, though, is of the two, the straight man in this movie, you know, that. Again, it's funny that he's playing a very similar nerd type, but the way he's positioned in these three different stories is different. You know, he's the cool guy in, you know, Hiding Out. He's the nerdy best friend in Pretty in Pink. And in this one, you know, he is your romantic lead. You know,
yeah.
And Daniel Roebuck. And he's made to look somewhat.
Because Catherine Mary Stewart from Night of the Comet shows up.
Exactly. And they're a romantic pair. And you have, even early on, this kind of funny scene where he is being gazed at by a beautiful woman when they're at a diner or a Chinese restaurant, and he walks over to talk to her, and you're
a new wave princess in her own right.
Yeah. And it looks like, I mean, this is kind of a save the cat moment in terms of just like him being desirable, right? This is like your good looking guy, but he's also a geek enough to get his ass kicked by her bigger boyfriend. It's like a Bluto kind of comedy scene.
Oh yeah. It's totally like Bluto and Olive Oil. Yeah. And like, he just body slams John Cryer. And yeah. John Cryer, to his credit, commits, and so does Daniel Roebuck, they both commit to the pretty taxing, it looks like, physical comedy that goes on. Like,
oh, yeah.
They get the shit beat out of them and thrown through multiple tables, and they go through car wrecks and everything. Like,
yeah.
There's a real almost like Looney Tunes, Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote element to their adventures.
Almost not far off from Tommy Boy either. Like that.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of,
I didn't
kind
think
of,
about
kind
that.
Kind of cartoony road movie.
Yeah, because she directed Black Sheep, right?
Oh, she did.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, so
which also makes sense because she talked about Chris Farley in that Q&A that I saw her at, and like how special and close they got during their time making Black Sheep.
Well, and it is interesting to go from a movie like this, which I don't think ultimately works that well. It is a nice kind of little curio, but when you get to her doing the SNL stuff where you have comic geniuses like that she can collaborate with and bring her wild kind of zany creativity to the way she tells his stories, and you get fucking, you know, Dana Carvey and Mike Myers.
Well, it also pulls in our previous subject, Rob Lowe, to be the bad guy.
Yeah.
In Wayne's World.
Yeah.
So we were also supposed to do O.C. and Stiggs, which is a riff on the John Cryer kind of mold, and which was based on like a National Lampoon comic, and Robert Altman directed it. And that's also, that's closer to this movie too, because it's about two freewheeling nerds during kind of 80s Reagan America and how they're more or less just out to make a buck, you know, and they do it through pretty outrageous, goofy means. But that one's seen as kind of one of the, if not the nadir, but like one of the nadirs of Altman's worst period, we'll say.
Yeah, I've heard it's like next to Nashville, like the worst, right?
Next to Nashville?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Next to McCabe and Mrs.
Yeah,
Miller.
The shit stuff.
Yeah, the really garbage Robert Altman stuff. But we talked off mic That neither one of us are big Altman guys.
And we're joking because we both love Nashville. It's the one that we both like.
Yeah, to be clear, McCabe, Mrs. Miller, that's a masterpiece.
Yeah, Nashville's like top 10 favorite movie.
Yeah.
But
I'm thinking more along the lines of like, I know people really like this movie. I'm not one of them, but Popeye.
Okay.
That early 80s, goofy, kind of zany comedy. And it's Altman trying his hand again at making an artsier version, I guess, of like the teen 80s movie that became popular. And it just, for many people, doesn't work.
Yeah.
So we want to get to questions.
Let's do it.
All right. Questions about John Cryer. You know what? We're not even going to really do questions about John Cryer's filmography. There's going to be one John Cryer question here, but we kind of figured since it's the last episode of our Brat Pack miniseries that we may as well do like an overarching set of questions.
Totally.
But the first one is going to deal with John Cryer. Before the Bratz documentary, now, and be serious, did you ever associate John Cryer with the Brat Pack?
Not at all.
Right? That was the thing. And I think that's also what compelled me to say we should do his own episode is because, like, when he showed up, he also kind of shows up unannounced in the movie, just being interviewed by Andrew McCarthy. It looks like on a Zoom call. And, like, yeah. I never thought or associated him with this group of actors. I always, in my mind, Anthony Michael Hall was the dork, to go back to kind of our original point, where John Cryer may have been Brat Pack adjacent, but then, like, you look at it and you're like, it totally makes sense because, I mean, like, Pretty in Pink, he's in it with fucking Andrew McCarthy and James Spader. No Small Affair, he's in it with Demi Moore. Like, he's showing up with all of these other actors too. He just kind of stealthily maybe evaded, or maybe he evolved to become, in our eyes later, like a big TV actor, kind of like Rob Lowe. I never thought of him as like being part of this group.
It might just be, honestly, he's in one classic from that era.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
And like, the fact that he's in the one that also is with Howard Deutsch, who's also featured pretty prominently in the Bratz documentary that McCarthy thought to loop him in, also because McCarthy's in that movie too. But like, I honestly, based on all the movies that we watched, like, I would probably choose James Spader as being part of the Brat Pack more than being, John Cryer being in it.
You know, do you think it's weird, though, that maybe the reason Spader didn't is he's a bad guy? You know what I mean? Like, the Brat Pack, when I think, is that, how they were created was these are the people you want to hang out with as they are in their movies. Almost, especially that we talked about in the first episode of St. Elmo's Fire, right?
Yeah,
And having a villain. And I think Ducky might be suffering the same fate. He's not part of the cool group, especially in the biggest one, Pretty in Pink. But you want to be Andrew McCarthy in this, and you want to be in those sexy scenes like them looking at each other in the record store.
Yeah.
And Ducky's a very famous character from this, but I don't consider him like people weren't wanting to be him as much. At least I didn't.
Nobody wanted to be Ducky.
No one still wants to be Ducky.
Now, I guess that leads to question number two, since we mentioned the TV acting part, is that who do you think is the richest brat now?
So, I mean, he's worth a lot of money.
Yeah, Two and a Half Men.
Two and a Half Men, syndication.
200-something episodes.
Yeah, 232 or 52.
Jesus Christ.
12 or
13. He's getting checks literally every day.
Yeah. He got a check today guaranteed for more than I'm making this year.
Yeah.
Like, I would bet. And
he's now also playing, as you pointed out to me, Lex Luthor.
Yeah, so the CW is kind of their connected universe of, like, Legends of Tomorrow and Arrow and Flash and shows like, and Supergirl, I believe, as well. He plays Lex Luthor, shaved head, which I originally thought was a joke to play on him being the sidekick to Gene Hackman in Superman 4, Quest for Peace. And I remember as a kid, I was like, I think the longest time I didn't like John Cryer because he is nails on a chalkboard in that movie.
He's horrible.
He's Ducky turned up to like 15.
Yeah.
Like it's the same character.
So shrill. But then again, that's that whole movie.
Well, that's canon too of them like not knowing
what to do with a thing.
They're like, oh, those I want Ducky. Get me the Ducky guy. You know?
And I want the Duck Man.
It's so fucking bad, dude.
That's my Israeli accent.
I just rewatched Electric Boogaloo, and I'm just going to imagine them yelling for, and John Cryer being like, cool.
Sure, how much are you going to pay me?
But, I mean, Two and a Half Men, now this.
Rob Lowe has West Wing and Parks and Rec checks.
Yeah.
That brother is swimming in money. Like, he's Scrooge McDuck money.
And he had...
Now he's a podcaster. Go figure.
Yeah, and he also had some... bigger movies. I feel like he had more starring roles than like John Cryer did. Is that fair?
Well, also I think like him being in the Wayne's World movies,
yeah,
and
Tommy Boy
and stuff, like those also were huge syndicated films, especially in like the heyday of like Comedy Central.
Oh, yeah.
And he probably got some checks off of that too.
Totally.
Like I think Lowe's probably the most. Demi Moore's got to be up there too.
And
I mean,
then
married to Bruce Willis.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, being in big movies herself.
Oh, and with Ashton Kutcher, being in huge movies herself. But I mean, she also got tanked with Striptease, so who knows?
Well, and then you have, I mean, Emilio, I think, is doing very fine.
He's doing fine, but I don't think, he don't have Rob Lowe money.
I mean,
what would be generating the dough for him?
I mean, Mighty Ducks honestly would be huge. That Disney
money.
It's
not Bobby. I'll tell you that much.
Which they shot a lot of that here.
Here?
In Austin.
In hell?
In Austin, Texas. I think Emilio would be like the top, though.
No. Rob Lowe's the top.
No, not the very top, but toward the top of like...
Because of Mighty Ducks?
I think Mighty Ducks is just other projects, and also just his dad.
Yeah.
It might not be like for making money off movies or roles, but you know, kind of the family.
Yeah, it's fair. It's certainly not Judd Nelson.
True.
He's running an Arby's.
There's a Schlotsky's, I heard.
It's a Schlotsky's? It's a KFC Taco Bell Pizza Hut combo.
Yep.
Now, here's an interesting question. Only because I authored it.
if I like this one because I wrote it.
If we continued this series or replaced an episode, who do you think would be the actor we should have done an episode on?
Molly Ringwald.
Really?
Yeah, just straight up. Because I just think, I mean, I like what we picked, and I think we picked some more off the beaten track stuff. But, like, we didn't get to do 16 Candles directly. We didn't do Breakfast Club directly.
We did Breakfast Club for Emilio.
Well, for Emilio, but I mean, like, I would say 16 Candles for sure, and then that's the main one. And also just her as a star.
I mean, we just did Pretty in Pink.
Yeah, but I just mean as a star.
We did two of them.
But I mean, her as her own thing. I think that, like...
Yeah, our series was very dude-centric.
Yeah, and I think when you ask a lot of people, like... Who's the first person you think of when you think 80s?
It is Molly.
It's Molly. Like she's the one because she also was just that. Like it's so specified. Like I guess she's like she almost would be a better documentary subject for Bratz than Andrew McCarthy, of like what happens when you are built for a specific time and place, that you help create what is hot it girl, and then that goes away.
Did you think Molly Ringwald was hot?
No.
Really? I was very attracted.
Well, I think she's beautiful, beautiful woman. I don't find her, I just never been attracted to her in that way. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think again, like she would be a fascinating thing to focus.
Is it because she's a strong, independent woman and pretty in pink? And
well, yeah, just, I mean,
you can't handle that because of all your time on the 4chan boards.
Yeah, between that and Acolyte, I just get fucking fired up, man.
Any lesbian Jedi witches, you're like,
just not.
They remind you of Molly Ringwald,
and I get really, really angry. And
I would have done a whole James Spader episode, and argued for him being part of the Brat Pack, because I mean, like, he again shows up in multiple movies that we covered as the bad guy, and then also was in just some of my favorite movies from that time period.
Tough Turf,
The New Kids.
Oh, he's great, New Kids.
Yeah, but he's playing variations on the same role. Like, Tough Turf is like him, almost like if Steph was the good guy of the movie. And then also just his evolution as an actor, like Bad Influence we covered, which he plays a different kind of version of his usual character. And then going up into the 90s when he's in, you know, Cronenberg's Crash, he's, you know, fucking leg wounds and shit. Like, he's a weird actor, man. And I really like him. He's
peaking with Blacklist, you know?
Yeah. I was just about to say, he looks like he swallowed Judd Nelson and is on the Blacklist. Age of Ultron, too. We got to cover Age of Ultron.
Oh, I mean, that would be
the masterpiece.
Yes.
And finally, as we close out Brat Boy Summer, what was the favorite of the movies that we covered? Of the Bratz movies?
I mean, I think Pretty in Pink's the best.
Yeah, that or Breakfast Club are probably the best. I have my pick, but you go.
But I would say for new viewing, I loved Class. That was one that I liked.
Yeah, you really did like that movie.
That one like really just got to me. For fun, I had a blast watching Wisdom with You. Like, I thought I was going to lose my goddamn mind.
You were laughing so fucking hard.
I don't think you've ever heard me laugh that hard. I'm sorry, but I was like, that movie made me fucking lose my shit.
I mean, it's bonkers
so funny.
Work. Of something.
But I would say that, honestly, reconnecting with The Outsiders, which I really like.
Repo Man was in there.
Yeah, Repo Man. I mean, that's up there for the best of the bunch in terms of movie that also is important to me.
Yeah, I mean, Repo Man creeps close to like top 10 movie of all time for me.
Yeah, easily.
I mean, Less Than Zero is my pick.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's the most Jacob-coded movie ever.
Ever.
And it's just revisiting it, like it just washed all over me again, to where I was like, oh, that's right. This movie was formative for my ass for a reason.
What was your favorite first watch?
Probably Class.
Yeah. It's interesting, right?
Yeah, it's a cool movie, and it's just tonally weird, and it has some great performances, and I really like, it's one of the few Andrew McCarthy movies I hadn't seen yet, and like, he's good in everything, in my opinion, so, you know. Yeah, that would be my pick.
I could like watch it again. I found it like strangely entertaining too. Like, I liked the world of those friends, you know.
Yeah. Cliff Robertson's leathery tan.
Oh yeah.
It's something. Well, Martin, this has been great.
Indeed.
We're about to embark on season 6 of this stupid long-running podcast that we do together.
But we're entering spooky season, y'all.
Yeah.
It's time.
To give you guys a heads up, this next season is going to be hardcore shit. We're going back to the secret handshake ethos. There ain't going to be any mainstream garbage, no MCU butt fuckery,
which we've never done.
No Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, Kevin Costner fastball up your anus.
Grown-ups too.
There might be an Adam Sandler
cheaper
episode.
By the dozen.
Cheaper by the dozen. Ride Along 3. None of these movies will be covered, nor will they be acknowledged in my obituary. But what we will cover will blow your mind and hopefully give you a slight boner. But you'll have to tune in to more Secret Handshake to find out more, or just stop listening entirely.
We'll see you then.
Bye.
Touch you twice.